5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I know you're gonna dig this.
You make $5 million a year. I'm a jerk on the radio, I know better.
Those are facts. Print that. Tweet that.
I don't like people or teams or products that dodge the heavy lifting.
If you don't like what we say or anybody says, here's what I would suggest. Get a rating.
The idea that you preface your opinion by what your identity is to me insane.
You gotta be kidding me. You can't run this clown out of town fast enough.
This man is a disgrace. He's throwing everything away. Get him the hell out.
That is a take. It's a strong take. It's one of the best takes ever.
Welcome to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. Now, here's your host, Jason Barrett.
Before I even get into front selling this podcast, is that open not kick ass or what? Maybe it's me and it's brand new and so I'm a little more jacked up about it than the old one, but damn, I love the way that sounds. Let me know your thoughts. Jay Barrett at sportsradiopd.com. If you're unfamiliar with the voice, I am Jason Barrett. This is the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. We're up to episode 7 of season 3. If you haven't caught any of the prior 6 episodes, go on to sportsradiopd.com or go on to iTunes. Check out some of the previous conversations. I think you'll find them to be worth your time. As for this episode, I'm thrilled to connect with Lance Zierlein. Lance does mornings in Houston on ESPN Houston 97.5 FM. He works alongside John Granato. The two men have had a great run in Houston on a number of radio stations. What I love about Lance is that he brings you a credible, informed opinion, but he can also make you laugh out loud by introducing some of his character voices. Just a uniquely talented guy. You'll learn during our conversation, I tried to lure him to the Bay Area. Didn't exactly work out. We'll get into those details and a lot more during our discussion. In the meantime, for those of you who work in the sports media industry, the Barrett Sports Media Programming Summit is coming to Los Angeles. We'll be at the Grammy Museum February 21st and 22nd, 2019. LeBron James and the Lakers have taken on the Houston Rockets on the 21st. So if you needed extra incentive, there you go. For those of you who just want to learn about the business, though, I encourage you to check it out. Buy a ticket. Reserve your hotel room in advance. If you have questions about speaking or sponsorship opportunities, reach out to me via email, jbarrett@sportsradiopd.com. But that's not why you're here today. You came for the conversation with Lance Zierlein, so I'm going to get out of the way and bring it to you.
3, 2, 1.
All right, Lance, let's go back to the beginning because your career in Houston, we've got plenty of time to talk about that. But I want to talk about when you decided this was going to become a path you wanted to pursue, who you were listening to, who you were watching, and ultimately what your father told you, because your dad's a lifetime coach. Yeah. I can't expect that he was probably thrilled of you going to the dark side, right?
Yeah. You know what? I came up listening to sports talk with my dad, as a matter of fact. He was coaching at University of Houston, and he was a young coach, and I would listen to a show called Martini and Edmonds, and I remember as a kid listening to sports talk, and I found out what a coach likes and doesn't like about sports talk. You know, it's okay to have an opinion, but do your homework. I got into sports talk when I took kind of a non-traditional route. I was working a 60-hour-a-week job, making about $400 a week. I mean, making nothing at some car repair place because some guy who I had worked with at a restaurant said they wanted to hire customer service people. I said, I don't know anything about cars. What are you talking about? He said, you don't have to. You know, it's high-end car repairs, and they want somebody who's good with sales and customer service. And so I was miserable, hated it. So I quit. I started my own football handicapping business because I had learned how to analyze and handicap games when I was going to school at Tulane in New Orleans. I would go to the pool halls. I wouldn't go to class so much, but I would go to the pool halls, and I met a guy named Pete Parmalee who had just retired from Freeport MacMoran. He was in finance. And he taught me about solving the puzzle. He didn't look at it as a gambling thing, and really, frankly, I didn't really either. I looked at it as, hey, this is a chance to figure out how much better Team A is than Team B, and what are the factors that lead to a team being better than another team on any given day. And I learned from him, And so I said, you know what? I'm going to start up my own sports business, a handicapping business, and I'll do some fantasy football because I just started, and this is in 94. So I wrote this letter. I sent it out to Michigan City, Indiana, and WQAM in Miami, and Houston, and Baton Rouge. As a 24-year-old with no real experience, you know, I dressed it up as much as I could. And believe it or not, I was doing an afternoon show with WQAM with a guy named Jeff Rimmer.
Mm-hmm.
I was on once a week on Thursdays, and I was doing Houston on Saturdays with Matt Thomas, who I ended up 20 years later co-hosting a show with him here in Houston. We were both pops at that particular time, and he had his own weekend show. I had a Baton Rouge show because my dad was at LSU at the time, so it was kind of an easier way to get on. And then WIMS in Michigan City, Indiana. And what it allowed me to do was give out a phone number where people could call and get picks for me, so it helped, you know, sustain me at that time. But more importantly, it helped me fine-tune delivery on radio and not being nervous and how to have a strong opinion and how to back your opinion up. And from there, I've got my company called Pigskin Sports, and 610 AM was launching in the fall of 94 and into 95. And I was lucky enough to get on Mike Edmonds, who was the program director and who was one of the hosts of the shows that I would listen to when I was a kid, Martini and Edmonds. He was Mike Edmonds. He knew my dad from his U of H coaching days, and he said, why don't you come on? We need some, you know, programming anyway, and you can talk college and pro football with one of our hosts. And so I would come on and do that, and it was invaluable because it really did teach me radio on the fly. You know, a lot of times you can go to school to learn whatever you want to at Syracuse or Missouri or wherever you're going, Northwestern, but you either have good bullshit or you don't. And if you have good bullshit and you're well-reasoned and you're well-read, you can be unstoppable if you know how to deliver and you know how to convince people. And eventually the guy who ran the station, a guy named Dickie Rosenfeld, he said, why don't you do a weekend show with another guy? And so I worked for free for a couple of years doing a free weekend show, and then he gave me a weekend show.
How did you get started on 610 doing a morning show when you really hadn't done a full-time, five-day-a-week, you know, morning or afternoon drive-time show?
I've got to drive you bananas as a sports program director because that's the anti of what you would ever see now. Wait, what's your background? Oh, I do weekends.
Well, remember this, though, Lance. It was, what, 1997? So, I mean, the formats change a lot. Like, my opinion back then would have probably been like, I'm just glad to hear anybody on the radio talking sports.
It wouldn't happen now. I wouldn't get that opportunity. At that time, Granato's like, it happened at the last second, and Granato's like, hey, Dickie, I know Lance Zerline. He comes out to my TV tapings. We've gotten to be kind of buddy-buddy. He's a young guy. And look, Dickie saw an opportunity where he thought I was pretty good. I had experience doing weekend shows. I was good with the picks, which he liked anyway. He knew I knew my stuff. And I was cheap. And so there I was doing morning sports radio. And before you knew it, the old guard who had been listening, they didn't like it. I mean, here were two guys. I was 27. John was 37. And we were just full of piss and vinegar and, you know, references to movies. And we were having fun and being loud and having all this energy. And the guys who had been listening, you know, this is how it is in radio, Jason. You have to be patient and flush out old listeners. The previous listeners of an average radio show or below average radio show, you can't let those squeaky wheels get the grease mm-hmm. because you don't care about them as listeners anyway. You want to move forward. And Dickie panicked a little bit, I think, in the beginning because the old guys at his country club were like, hey, these young guys are too crazy and loud. And he brought in a guy named Ed Shane, who was an industry consultant. And Ed Shane came in and talked to us. And, you know, we kind of felt bad about ourselves. Like, we thought our show was going really well. And Ed came and talked to us and kind of came to the conclusion that the things we were doing probably is what we should keep doing. Well, then the books came out, and the books didn't come out as frequently back then. The books came out, and our ratings were starting to really move up. By the next book, we had really shot up. Now, he didn't tell us all this. He kind of kept it quiet from us in case we tried to, you know, ask for more money. He said he wanted to sign me to a two-year contract. I didn't have a contract for the first 6 months. And then when he signed me, I didn't get the first 6 months. Like, It wasn't time served on my contract. It actually started. So he had me under the same exact amount for 2.5 years. And after the first year, when we started having all this success, Dickie, he locked us in. And in fact, the show went from being 6 to 9 a.m. to 7 to 11 a.m.
I mean, because you guys were together for basically a decade there. You had a lot of success together, you and John. What ultimately led to you guys at that point disbanding?
But I think what really turned is around, we started in 97 together. Around 2001, new management came in, and they'd come in from 740, who was the all-news station, the really big one.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to come in, and, you know, sometimes when management comes in, they just couldn't leave well enough alone. We had a successful show. We had a bunch of listeners. We had branding called The Bench, and our listeners were bench warmers. But they had to, well, we're going to take away the show called The Bench, and we're just going to call it John and Lance. Like, okay. And we're going to add this host, Russ Small, who was, ironically enough, the guy who was supposed to be on with John previously. But the reason they did that is because the Texans were coming. We were going to have the Texans at 6:10, and they wanted Russ Small to be the voice of the Texans. And even though the Texans said, no, we're not going to have this guy as our voice, they basically said, well, we just paid that much money, so we're going to have whoever we want as the voice of the Texans, and we've got to put him on our air somewhere to make money off of him, because the station pays the talent, not the Texans.
Right.
And so they tried to force him on our show. Well, our listeners revolted, and we lost 65% of our rating, and this over the course of a year. And it wasn't until four advertisers, I want to say they were each spending about $150,000 plus a year, they came together and said, if you don't take this guy off the radio, we're going to pull our advertising. It was then that they finally pulled the guy. But it took over a year and a half for us to get our ratings back to where they had been. And I would argue that the show, a little bit of it died.
Ultimately, you leave 6:10. You and John, though, you resurface on KGOW. I read the Houston Press gave you guys show of the, you know, best show on the market in 2008. So obviously, even though at that time you're feeling like, hey, maybe this show has lost some of the steam that it had before, kind of feeling like a fresh start in a new place.
Yeah, that was huge. Because so John Granato was behind closed doors. 6:10 had failed to pay him for live spots, like $1,600 worth of live spots. They just fucked up on the accounting.
Mm-hmm.
No, pardon my French. So he sued them. Well, Lou, then I know that was an opportunity for him, a loophole, to start this other station. There was already a group of people looking to start another station. I knew nothing about this. He comes into a show in April of 2007 and says, hey, I'm just going to let you know this is probably going to be my last show here. I'm like, what? The fuck are you talking about? I'm about to go on vacation. And he just tells, yeah, I'm about to sue the station. They owe me about $1,600. They're probably going to fire me. He ended up getting out of the contract. They let him walk because they owed him money and they didn't pay him. So they didn't have a case. They let him walk. And so I'm stuck there at 6:10. But he couldn't tell me everything that was going on, because if it ever went to court, they didn't want me being called as a witness and put me in that position. When they realized they weren't going to be able to sign me to a long-term contract and that I might go over with John, they basically just kept me off the air. And we eventually had to negotiate my way out of the rest of that contract. I probably didn't handle it right. I probably cost myself too much money. But anyway, we went over to 1560. And, JB, this is like getting a shot of B12 injection. I mean, new life. We could do the show how we wanted to. We had a small but devoted group of listeners who knew about us. And it was literally John and Lance and all of their friends. Like, we had Sean Pendergast, who's now on 6:10, and John Harris, who I grew up with as a friend, and we had these great young talent around us. We built a culture, and it was so exciting to be part of something that had so much energy, so much passion. We floated in and out on other people's shows. The SEC guy became a big character while we were at that station, which was a character that I did that gained some notoriety nationally. I started a handicapping character called Tony the Hatchet Man Valentine, because we could try things, and everyone there wanted each other to succeed. And I've never been in another station ever at any point where we had that much great energy and that much flow. Me taking that time off also, by the way, for people who are listening, who are in radio, if you ever have to go through a non-compete, it's going to hurt financially, but the ability to re-energize yourself and to be ramped up for your entry into your new job,
I'm telling you, it can be a real advantage. And it was for me when I went into 1560. I did some of the best radio I've ever done at 1560.
So given that you were that elated being at 1560, now tell me why exactly you wound up leaving.
Okay, first of all, we had signal issues because they thought they were getting a 50,000-watt station. And it wasn't really a 50,000-watt station. We were at the whim of daylight savings time and some other things. And for the morning show, that's not great when people can't hear your first hour,
right,
especially in a city where it's as sprawling as Houston. But we still were number one in ratings. After the first year, we got encoded. In the very first book, we were number one. We were beating 610. We had all this awesome content. We had people who could improv and jump on each other's shows. Guys would create parody songs on the fly during a break. That's how good it was. Unfortunately, we had a sales staff there that were going out and drinking all the time and doing things that they weren't supposed to do. And so, you know, we had great ownership, but the guys who were entrusted to run it, they looked at it as their own big playground, and they caused the infrastructure to get extremely weak. And it really did damage not only, you know, to the financial viability, but also to the morale, because our side of the building, we were busting ass and creating some great content, and the other side of the building was just screwing off. By 2011, I started thinking, you know, I need to do what's best for me and for my family. And so I was working without a contract. It wasn't any big deal. I was still getting paid the same amount of money. But I also knew I was free to leave whenever I wanted to because I was not contractually obligated. And I had a conversation with the Clear Channel station, which obviously is now iHeart. And before you knew it, I was going over there. And I don't know that I've ever gotten past. Honestly, Jason, to this day, part of me died a little bit. If we would have had a better infrastructure and a better signal, we would have dominated the market, and that's all you'd be talking about is, you know, the family tree of talent that we had grown at that one location. And it wasn't our fault. We just kind of, the infrastructure was just lousy.
You mentioned how, you know, the place obviously wasn't built for success in other departments, which is what led you ultimately to say, all right, I got to look out for me. I got to go to a place where we're going to have better structure. And so when you went to Sports Talk 790, I mean, you mentioned earlier in the conversation how you had crossed paths with Matt Thomas early in the career before you got started as a full-time host. You worked with him. You worked with Adam Clanton over at 790. And you had a 6-7 year run there.
You're right. You're right. And I went over there and I took like a $50,000 pay cut just to go over and have a chance to hit reset on my radio career because I didn't like where it was going. I don't like just going in and cashing checks, you know, punch in, punch out, go home. I wanted to get my passion back. I co-hosted the show in the morning with two guys that I'd known for years, Matt Jackson and Adam Wexler. Then the station moved me in with Charlie Palillo, an afternoon host. They wanted me to bring some life to that, but Charlie is Charlie, so he's going to do his show, and I don't care who you add with him. That's nothing's going to change. He's going to do his type of show. And then they said, I'll never forget, they called me and said, okay, Lance, we're moving you back to mornings. You and Adam Clanton are going to be the morning show hosts, and it's going to start at 6 a.m., and it's going to start this upcoming Monday. And I was like, holy shit. I mean, this is okay. Do we have time to prep? Can I talk about the co-host? And, you know, it wasn't a great marriage between the two of us, but something that you know, and you know this to be the case, Jason, I had a conversation with you, actually, about there were snippets where I'd get my old magic back and I would really take off. And I had some really, really strong shows. I had a conversation with you about, you said, why are you the second guy? Why don't you lead the show? And I said, well, I've always been the second guy. Granato was, you know, he would lead me and I'm the guy that does the funny stuff. And I certainly had a lead role, but I don't like coming in and out of breaks, things like that. So after we had that conversation, I basically said, you know what? I'm just going all in. I'm going to do what I want to do. And my co-host will have to get on board because I know that I've been doing this for a while and I know what good radio is. And he was still kind of, that was his second drive time job. And I just basically did the show I wanted to do. And I just said, this is fun and I'm going to have fun and I'm going to use my producer to have fun. And my co-host, if he wants to get on, we'll all have fun together. And we had a run of really high-rated shows there in the morning. We didn't always get along, me and my co-host, and we don't have the same sensibilities in terms of a radio show. But I remembered our conversation that you and I had, and I just thought, Jason's right. I got to do the show I do and let everything else fall into place. I can't just acquiesce to a co-host if I don't think he's going to be able to match what I'm doing. We had really high shows. I mean, I made a lot of money back on bonuses, ratings bonuses, for a year and a half. we dominated the market for a year and a half. And it felt good to me to know that, A, it wasn't John and Lance. This was Lance. This was me. I'd been able to accomplish something. I was able to kind of prove something to myself. And it was at that time in the summer of 14 where I had a tough decision to make. You may remember that.
Oh, yeah. We're going to get into that. The funny thing is you mentioned how you and I had had the chat and I had mentioned about driving the show. And that was definitely in the fall of 2013. And I had listened to you previously, but what triggered it was you had went on that Houston Texans rant. And I remember hearing it and I went, damn, this is good. And I sent you a note just to say, hey, man, I just happened to be dropping in. Hell of a piece of content. Nice job. Keep up the good work. And that's something that, you know, for people who are listening now, I always tell this to PDs. You've got to listen every day to somebody new. Like, not just your radio station. Yes, you love your guys. Yes, you're listening to them. But you're hurting yourself if you don't put your ear on other people because you have no idea when your paths are going to cross. And as it turns out, we developed a rapport, started going back and forth. And somewhere down the line, you know, it happens in radio, something is going to change. And there I am, the summer, I think it is, of 2014, Bucher, Towney, and Huff. We all saw the writing on the wall when Aubrey said he's not moving to the Bay. Rick, I think, at that point was welcoming any kind of change. And so here I am with a need in mornings. And I'm like, you know what? Lance Erline's a guy I should be talking to. So you come to the market. We have breakfast. You do a hit with Haberman and Middlecoff, which went pretty well. I ultimately put a very lucrative piece of paper in front of you.
Not the first offer.
No, the last one.
Yeah, the last one. Jason, are we really doing this where I'm going to act like this first offer is feasible in San Francisco? Come on.
Hey, listen, if you only knew half of the battle to get the first offer, that's just corporate. But nonetheless, yeah. You ultimately get put in a situation where you got to choose. Like, this is a really, I mean, we're talking market four. It's a big situation, a big opportunity. And you're one of those guys who likes to take on Goliath and prove that you can knock him off, which is the way I'm wired. But ultimately, because of family, you chose not to. So my question to you, after all of that, is how many times over the last 4 years have you kicked up, waking up, screaming, going, what the hell did I do not going to the Bay Area?
So you know what? I thought about it for the first 4 months. It weighed heavily on my mind because I wasn't really – we had good ratings on the show, and I wasn't really super jazzed about the show that we were doing together.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you now, my boss, Eddie Martini, he ended up giving me more than I was going to agree on. I think he was, you know, happy I stayed. And that was really killing me for about 2 months. And there were multiple times, I would think about it all day long, and there were multiple times where I said, you know what, we're going. And I told my wife, we're going to go. She said, well, I'm staying here until after I run my marathon. It's going to be my first ever marathon, the Houston Marathon.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew I was going to have to move down, live alone from September to whatever, January, February. And that didn't bother me as much as the fact that my wife was going to have 5 kids she had to take care of on her own. That did bother me a little bit. I had to make sure that she was going to mentally be in the right place. And ultimately, I just wasn't 100% convinced that it was going to be the right move for all parties involved. But there were times for the first 4 or 5 months that I was like, man, I wonder what the weather is. I kept the weather on Weather Channel on my app just so I could check what – I would check what San Francisco's weather was. I said, look at this shit.
Yep.
But I'll tell you when I stopped worrying about not going to San Francisco, it was twofold. One, when you left, and I'm like, holy crap, JB left, and you would have been one of the reasons I'd come down to San Francisco.
Right.
That was one. But the second one was when somebody from NFL.com reached out to me late October and said, we want you to start doing draft writing for us, our draft prospects. Can you do this? I realized then and there, the workload is so heavy for my NFL draft work from basically November to February that it would have been impossible for me to have moved to San Francisco in September to do the job on the radio that I needed to do for you and for everyone else at that station and advertisers for 4 hours a day. And then on top of learning all these new teams and advertisers and learning the market, try to do the NFL job. I would have had to sacrifice the NFL opportunity.
Right.
Here I am 5 years later, and it's a big part of who I am and what I do.
You know, there are a lot of people who are probably listening to this podcast who work in the business who will watch, whether it's yourself, Mike Mayock, Kiper, McShay, and they'll think, okay, here comes the guy for 2 months to do the draft work. He's, you know, talking about a bunch of college football games. They have no idea of the level of preparation that goes in. But take people through what actually goes into that, how long you do that job. Is it year-round? Is it, you know, seasonal?
Yeah, so for me, it is seasonal, but the season is a lot longer than you probably think. Let's say the draft has ended. In June and July, I'm watching tape because NFL.com asked me to write articles about top 10 quarterbacks to watch, top 10 running backs to watch for 2018, for example. And I've got to know not just seniors, but seniors, juniors, and sophomores, the biggest names. And I'm looking at it kind of with an eye to the draft, but I'm not overtly talking about the draft with sophomores. You know, we have to kind of walk a fine line because we're not trying to promote guys leaving early from college football. And so I'm watching tape on 18 quarterbacks. So I've got my college tape and I'm watching, I'm writing notes, and then I've got to write an article on quarterbacks. Then I do the same thing for running backs. I probably watched about 19, 20 running backs, and I wrote my notes on that, and then I wrote my list of top 20. And so there's a lot of – I probably looked at about 150 college football players on tape this summer in June and into July. Mm-hmm. Then I went to Indianapolis Colts camp and studied under Chris Ballard and Rex Hogan and Ed Dodge, some of those guys there to kind of sharpen my process. I'm somebody who – I've got a good relationship with Chris Ballard, the GM. He's kind of been a mentor in many ways and teach me. He was a listener of the radio show. He used to love the radio show. He loved 1560. Mm-hmm. He thought it was hilarious. Well, I got to know Chris when he was a listener in Houston as a scout for the Chicago Bears. And it's also how I met Alonzo Highsmith, who works now for the Cleveland Browns and for years with the Green Bay Packers. It's how I met Reggie Cobb, who works for the San Francisco 49ers and formerly the Tampa Bay Bucks. These were all guys who listened to me and John on the radio, and because they felt like they knew me, we immediately had this rapport. Well, those guys all ended up helping me become the person I am today with my draft stuff and understanding the game like I do from a personnel standpoint, a front office standpoint. I've got to write 500 players up. I've got to watch their college tape. I've got to read articles on them, who they are. I've got to try to do background work on who some of the best players are, what are the scouts hearing, what are general managers I know, coaches at the team, at the schools, what kind of guy is he? Is he a turd? Is he a good guy? Is he a leader? Has he had any issues medically? You know, uncovering medical stuff is extremely difficult. So I'm doing that as well. This all starts in the summer. August is like my time off. I don't do hardly anything in August. September, I start watching games like everyone else. By the way, I'm still doing a radio show, too, this entire time.
Right.
So September, I start watching the games. October, I'm really watching the games, but I'm starting to take notes on these players. And once November hits, and it really starts late October, I'm now getting my tape from the NFL into my tape machine that I can watch with an Xbox controller. I can go back and forth. I'm now watching tape on players, and once November hits, JB, I'm going into hyperdrive. That's whenever I have to really start getting it going, because by the combine, I have to have 400 players written up. Each player is going to take me a minimum of 40 minutes if you're not a great player, a maximum of 2.5 to 3 hours if you're a really good player, or especially a quarterback, a good quarterback. I got to watch game after game, throw after throw. I've got certain things that I'm looking for, critical factors and core factors. So every player is going to take up a lot of my time. I might get 5 of them done in a day. I will go up on Saturdays and work on Saturdays. And once December hits, I usually work on Saturdays and Sundays. So I work 7 days a week between radio and draft. December, January, and February, I'm working anywhere from 60 to 82 hours a week. I fly out to Mobile, Alabama to go to the Senior Bowl. So I will be on site, on location, but I'm only writing articles and draft profiles. Once February hits the combine, I will have already written 400 prospects out of 500 necessary. And the combine is where I go on TV on NFL Now, which is their digital platform. And I will broadcast from the combine with Matt Money Smith, who's now the play-by-play voice of the Chargers,
right,
and Bucky Brooks, who goes on NFL Network quite a bit. And we'll be three of the voices on the NFL Now platform talking about these prospects. I'll bust my ass after February, but by February, a lot of my heavy lifting's done. March, I'm chasing what's called ghost lists. I need to find guys who could be drafted, because if you get drafted, I have to do a draft profile for you, even if the draft is over. So I'm calling teams like, hey, who are some guys flying under the radar? I'm scouring pro day workout results. And the only way I can get them is doing a ton of research on online, or to have a contact on a team that will give me that info. And sometimes I get it and sometimes I don't, because guys who run fast, jump high, and have good size turn into players, and they get drafted a lot of times late in the draft. So I'm having to chase down all my contacts to find, hey, who are some more guys that I need to be looking at? That in and of itself is a lot of work in March. And this entire time, I'm also trying to keep my wife happy and the four kids who I have at home right now. And what that basically means is I got to take her on a trip to San Francisco or New York or Belize, because I make her a football widow for about 6 months.
Right.
But March actually isn't as hard for me. And in April, I start doing TV shows on the NFL Network. We do Mock Draft Live every week. I'll start doing some podcasts with Daniel Jeremiah every once in a while. I'll move the sticks. They'll fly me out to L.A. to do some TV shows, usually in early April. And by the end of April, I'll do three straight days of being the digital Mike Mayock, where I comment on every single pick that goes down over the entire draft. Because the truth is, there's really not going to be anybody else in the television, radio, or digital space who will have looked at as many players as I have. I take my work extremely seriously. I will not cut corners. I will not go fast on a guy just to get the work done. I've got to know these guys, and I got to try to help you as a fan, or you as a writer on a Chargers fan site. I want you to know who this guy is to the best of my ability, because it helps out the fan base and it helps out other media members who are trying to figure out who these sixth round and seventh round picks are. Every guy requires a shitload of work and time, and they deserve that. You know, if I'm going to go put my opinion about these guys out there on their strengths and weaknesses, the least I could do is put my time in and give a thoroughly well-researched opinion on them. And I learned that from my dad sitting in a car listening to sports talk radio, where I remember him turning to me and said, whenever you talk about sports, you better know what you're talking about before you have an opinion. And I never forgot that.
That's exhausting just thinking about all the freaking man hours that you have to do for it. Fortunately, the opposite of that is you do a number of characters on your radio programs that have always been a hit. And obviously, right. I don't think you just pull them out without working on them a little bit. But if you had to do the amount of work that you do on NFL draft profiles, you'd probably never do them. But you've done a number of characters, whether it was, you know, popular guys like Stephen A. and John Gruden, to creating your own characters. Take me through why you think voices are so important to a sports radio show, especially in morning drive.
Most of the people who are listening to us, I don't know about most of them, but a good percentage are going to do something that they don't really want to do, right? They're going into a job that they would rather not be at, or in many cases, they hate their jobs. They're not living the life that they wanted to live when they were, you know, growing up. And I recognize that I am living the life that I am. So the least I could do is try to entertain people who are driving in. And that's why morning shows, to me, you got to be having fun, you got to have energy, and you got to be unpredictable, so that people who are headed into maybe a mundane job or something they don't want to do, this is their respite from that. This is their time where they have some fun. And so you got to have some fun with them, and you got to help provide the fun. And I think when you can create interesting characters, do imitations or create good characters, you can bring them back multiple times, and it becomes a shared experience for the listeners. So you as a host and the listeners, you now have a shared experience of this character, and it's something that they can talk to their friends about. Did you hear what SEC guy said today, or whatever the case may be? You've created content that is memorable, which is what we should also be striving for, is creating memorable content. But you've also created something that is a shared experience between you, your co-host, and the listeners who you're trying to affect on a daily basis. Anything that you can do to add your own caffeine to the morning, which even if it's a voice or a character or something fun or something that has a ton of energy or something crazy that the listener doesn't see coming, I mean, I think we all have a job to kind of strive. We should be striving for that because that's what people want.
Right. I've got a couple quick things. You don't need to go too long on this, but there are a couple local things I want to throw by you. Obviously, you saw the story from the Super Bowl with Ennis and Payne. Some loved it, some didn't. From your vantage point, is that good for the business or bad for the business when, you know, two sports radio guys are going at it? You know, they say any press is good press, but from where you sit, do you like that?
I kind of changed my opinion a little on this, Jason, because I would say it adds some flavor and some variety and gets people talking. There's no question about that. But as I've been around longer and longer, I don't know if it's always good. What ultimately is the benefit of confrontational stuff? We played in the lowest common denominator a lot, especially in radio and probably more so on television. And when we play to the lowest common denominator, I think we lower our standards. And, you know, we had a big beef with 610 when I went to 1560. We were David and they were Goliath, and we slung the rocks at them, and people loved us for it. They were the evil empire, and we were taking shots at them, and I don't really regret that. But when you do stuff like for shock appeal, and I think Josh Inniske is a very talented host, but he comes from, you know, the Howard Stern school of this is how you do things, and you got to make a name for yourself, and you got to do some things that are going to generate interest. And I think that does work in a lot of cities, and it did get him a lot of attention. Seth Payne, clearly, who he had the beef with, a former NFL player, he's not a fan of it. He doesn't like it at all, and he responded that way. What you didn't talk about much is that 790 got kicked off of Radio Row, and people who had gone there, their very first Super Bowl ever, or a chance to go to a Super Bowl broadcast, were broadcasting from a Perkins restaurant. I mean, so you ended up costing the entire station an opportunity to do a show. And I know that wasn't Josh's intention, but that's what happened. So I don't have any problems with taking some shots. I think it can be good for radio. But at the same time, just understand and be okay with the fact that if you always go lowbrow all the time, you are going to be playing to the lowest common denominator. And that's what ultimately is going to follow you around to every other show that you do. I would rather be likable than to be controversial.
I wrote about this a few weeks ago. It's going to be, you know, one of those stories that'll hang above people's heads for the fall, and that's the whole anthem issue. And in your market, Houston, Sean Salisbury, a guy I know very well, announced that he's not going to talk about it at all on his show. Now, when Sean saw the piece, I think he took it the wrong way. I think he thought I was criticizing it. I wasn't. I was actually in favor of what he was doing. I was just trying to present both sides of it that, like, hey, listen, if all of a sudden on Monday the Houston Texans had all taken a knee on Sunday and you've said that you will not touch it, that's the danger that everybody in the market is now talking about it, and you're not. On the other hand, I commend them for it because I think, you know what, we've gotten to a point where sports is supposed to, as you said earlier, it's supposed to be the caffeine that you're coming for. You want to be entertained. You want to be informed. And this is supposed to be fun. And some of the, you know, we've lost some of that the last few years given the climate we're in. But from your vantage point, do you think more shows and stations should follow the pattern of what Salisbury's doing with not talking about it? Or do you think that you should leave that door open because you never know when news is going to break and you have to hit it?
A really good chef once told me, if you only cook for yourself, then people are going to stop coming to your restaurant. You can do stuff that you like to do, but at the same time, you do have to give people what they want. For what Sean's talking about, I'm okay with what he said here in Houston. Because listening to the different shows, there's no new takes. There's not anything new coming from it at all. All it does is grind some shows to a halt. Now, I remember when it first happened with Colin, it was a huge story. And frankly, Trump, you know, drummed everything back up and turned it into another story last year. But at this point, unless something new happens with it, I feel like it's talking about Tim Tebow's next performance at quarterback. Like, yeah, it was something that generated a lot of clicks, a lot of views, a lot of listens. Is it still doing that today? Like, are you still just trying to get those clicks, views, or listens, or are you actually is it counterintuitive? Is it doing damage to your listenership? And if you're going to talk about it, find something new, find a different way to approach it. Don't just do the same thing over and over. You know, come up with a new slant to it or a new angle. Ask a question based off of it, but don't do the same thing over and over. And I think that's what Sean was trying to avoid, is just doing the same stale radio where emotional arguments are made against each other. No one's listening. There is no headway being made from a listener standpoint, and you just try to create some controversy on the radio so you get a bunch of phone calls and you get a cruise in. I mean, that's not good radio either.
You're right. I think it's one of those fatiguing topics, and hopefully as we go forward, we'll be spending more time talking about games on Sunday rather than all the crap that happens before the game. But I want to get you out of here on quick hits. I'm going to pose four quick questions, just quick answer of what your response to each of these. Biggest reason you still enjoy doing this line of work after two decades is what?
It's my number one creative outlet.
The smartest mind you've learned from in the sports media industry would be who?
I had a great conversation with Jim Nantz. I'm sorry, it's in a short answer, but I want to give Jim Nantz these props. I call Jim Nantz up and leave him a message. Hey, this is Lance Zierlein. You know, I know you were at U of H. My dad coached at U of H. I'm trying to get into the business. You know, would love to talk to you sometime and just find out, you know, what I should be doing. We get those. Everyone gets those all the time,
right?
Multiple times per year if you're in this business. This guy calls me up at 9 o'clock a week later. Lance, Jim Nantz with CBS Sports. How are you? And I'm like, oh, I'm doing great. We spend 25 minutes on the phone talking about his path to getting into sports, how many days in a row he worked. Like, there were 2 years where he basically worked all but 5 days. Like, he had five different jobs. It was this incredible story of how Jim Nantz got started, and he shared it with me. And after he did that, I never forget. I was like, I will always try to give back to people who ask. I can't do it every single time, but I've done it more times than not. I think he was impactful in that way. But other than that, I'd say a lot of what I learned about some radio stuff, just conversations that I've had with you, have been very important for me personally.
One thing that concerns you most about the future of sports radio is what?
I would say becoming too formulaic. Because what it does, it makes you predictable. And when you're too formulaic, at times you become too predictable. And people don't do predictable anymore. They have to have some unpredictable.
And because those listening have not heard you do any of your characters, I'm going to leave you with this one. If you could do one character, only one, for the remainder of your career, which would you choose? and obviously you've got to answer it in that guy's voice.
I mean, without doubt, it'd be Tony the Hatchet Man Valentine, world-class handicapper from New Jersey. I'm telling you right now, guys, 1-800-676-5200. I got a chance to give you the very best picks. Football is underway. You can play every one of these games like they've already been played. I got a 5-team, 100 million star pick. Call today. I also got the brand new iPads. They just came right here in Sea Caucus. They're at the back of the subway. 1-800-676-5200. I got world-class handicapping and iPads for you right now. Tony, the Hatchet Man Valentine, and the Inside Sports Syndicate.
We were in the Bay Area when you called in as Philip Rivers on a mobile, and you were talking all sorts of shit about Colin Kaepernick. And I'm watching at the time I'm running the game, and I'm looking at our Twitter timeline because Kaepernick starts out pretty decent. And everybody that day is like invading Twitter, like, take that, Rivers. See, you didn't know what the hell you're talking. And I'm laughing my ass off. I was sitting on the couch going, these people think Philip Rivers is destroying Colin Kaepernick on Bay Area radio. It's amazing.
They were pissed off in Denver. Like, I was like, man, I'm telling you what, this guy is the worst. You guys, Case Keenum is he's like, I don't even know if I'm allowed to say midget anymore, but that's what he is. He's a little person. Man, he's somebody like who came straight off The Hobbit. You're not going to beat me with that. I got Danny Woodhead rolling with me, man. That's unbelievable. Although Woodhead's not there anymore.
Right.
But the Philip Rivers thing, I actually heard him after the Chargers beat the Denver Broncos, and he had his bolo tie on, and he was on the set. He's like, man, I'm just so fired up right now. I can't believe we beat the Denver Broncos. And I said, I think I might be able to do this. And sure enough, I unleashed it that day. And Philip Rivers has heard my Philip Rivers. He likes it. And the only issue that Philip Rivers had with my Philip Rivers is one time I said, man, I got like 8 or 9 kids. I don't even know how many kids I have now. I'm losing track. And Rivers is like, man, that's not true. I know exactly how many kids. That part's not funny at all.
Right.
I know my kids. I love them very much. And Nick Hardwick told me that.
Just Google search SEC guy, Bernie the Wolf Wolfson.
I've got a lot of them taped. And it was basically a play on Hootie Johnson way, way back. And then it just turned into the, you know, the obnoxious SEC fan who thinks they're the very best. And it started off like this, real slow. Listen, our players here in the Southeast are substantially better than the slow pokes up in the Northeast. We've got the finest. And then it kind of picked up. The tempo was faster. And I listen to old stuff, Jason. I'm not lying. I don't know where I get in character. And I said things that I don't remember saying, and I don't think I could come up with to this day. Like, I don't think I'm as quick-witted as I was with the character like 8 or 10 years ago. But I decided to retire it just because people don't understand the nuance of the character.
Right.
And, the you know, you'll have people misunderstanding the character who will be outraged.
My best friend, his brother is Johnny B. of the Jerky Boys. And, you know, he basically created all these characters. He went on to Family Guy, and he's, you know, he's had a hell of a career doing it. And so when I first started watching you, and I loved how, although every sports radio PD and host loves hearing Stephen A. and Gruden and those things because they're relatable to the audience, I was really into the original characters just because I'm like, nobody's really doing that on sports radio on a consistent fashion with all these different people, and you pulled it off well. So congrats, man. It's been a big part of your ability to entertain, and when you combine that with the work you've done, you know, in a credible sense as a host and now on NFL Network and NFL.com, it speaks to why you've had 2 decades doing this. So thanks for the time today, Lance. Good catching up.
Ah, oh, man, I love talking shop. Thanks, JB, for having me. I appreciate it.
I'd say that was a pretty successful broadcast.
Thank you for listening to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. To stay updated on the latest sports media news, follow Jason on Twitter at SportsRadioPD and visit our website, sportsradiopd.com.